Well, welcome to part two of Europa Rising. In the last session, of course, we reviewed the biblical background as to why so many scholars have been for centuries looking for a revival of the Roman Empire from the biblical text. We also reviewed how Rome fragmented in all those pieces. Each had their day in court, so to speak. But as Daniel prophesied, those pieces are coming back together in what apparently is a resurrection, if you will, of that ancient empire, at least in part. In this session, we're going to look at the European Union today and what are its prospects. Now, one of the questions that we should keep open, be thinking about, is it true? Is this empire being revived? You need to realize the Maastricht Treaty obsoleted the Treaty of Rome, the fabled treaty that started much of this. And the Maastricht Treaty provides for a centralized European superstate, a common foreign policy, a common military, a common currency, and common judicial proposals. And very radical, many people don't realize how extreme the Maastricht Treaty reached. But it's interesting, as you review these things, to realize we're dealing here with an entity that has an economic potential larger than the United States. We have a population of 280 million. Europe has a population of 446, depending on which ones end up joining. There are five European Union institutions. The Commission, of course, is the executive arm. It's equivalent in our thinking of the executive branch. It's really controlled by the Council of Ministers of the member nations. It also has a parliament that's formed in 1958. It's interesting that the emblem of the European Parliament is a woman riding a beast. And this is a snapshot of just a postage stamp which happens to feature the European Parliament's emblem. And again, to biblical scholars, it's rather provocative because of Revelation 17, 18, and so on. There's, of course, the Court of Justice, which is in The Hague. And another feature is the European Council and the European Central Bank. The Central Bank was established the 1st of June of 1998, and it's based in Frankfurt am Main in Germany, and it aims to maintain price stability with a single monetary policy. We'll talk more about that because it has implications that few people, I think, fully appreciate. This emblem of Europe, of course, I might mention that there's a classic painting by an Italian artist that is called The Rape of Europa. And it deals with an affair between the Greek god Zeus and the legendary beauty Europa. In Greek mythology, Zeus spotted and fell in love with the young princess as she picked flowers. And he changed himself into a handsome bull and carried her off to the island of Crete, where she bore him three sons. That's part of the legend, but it may very well be the background from which the European continent has been named from Greek mythology. But let's move on. The European Union, of course, is seeking enlargement. And that enlargement is following what we call the Copenhagen criteria, which we reviewed in the previous session. What's interesting is they're not creating barriers for these countries without helping them. They're actually funding the acquisition of these member nations. 67% of direct investment into these candidate countries was of EU origin in the first place. Over the last 6 years, the total trade between Europe and these candidate countries has increased 300%. That's over $200 billion per year. And what's interesting is the European Union enjoys a trade surplus of over almost $26 billion per year in trading with these candidate countries. To put that in perspective, the United States has a record trade deficit, not a surplus, a deficit, of $435 billion per year. So in contrast, Europe is in a positive trade surplus basis with their candidate countries, in contrast to the deficits that we have. Not only, don't confuse this with our federal debt, we also have a huge federal debt. This is the trade deficit. Every year, we buy more than we sell, to the tune of over $400 billion per year. The European Union also provides direct assistance to each of these candidates of over $3 billion per year. And it does that through three programs, one called FAIR, the ISPA, and the SAFARD. And all of this adds up to over $3 billion. We'll take a quick look at each of these. The fair was done by a council regulation back in 89, and it provides direct financial assistance to provide for pre-accession support. These are things that, for example, they have a part of it, about 30% of that budget is for institution building, structures, strategies, human resources, management skills, all those things that are needed to strengthen their economic, social, and regulatory and administrative capabilities. And the rest 70% goes to what they call ACWIS-related investment, and that's co-financing economic, social institutions, promoting market economy and capacity to cope with competitive pressures, things of that nature, and also investment in the infrastructure to secure compliance with in such areas as food safety, making the frontiers secure, testing and measuring equipment related to consumer protection, all that kind of thing. And now the budget under this one provision is almost 2 billion euros per year. The second program is called IPSA. It stands for Instrument for Structural Policies for Pre-Accession. This provides financial support for environmental and transport needs. It's drinking water, wastewater management, solid waste management, air pollution, those kind of things. And the Trans-European Transport Network is mostly, most of the money is going for improvement of the rail transport, about 40% for roads and a handful of other things, even an airport or two. The budget for IPSA is about $7 billion. Now, that's not per year. That's spread over a seven-year period. And most of it's going to Poland and Romania, but they're spread among all the candidates that we'll be talking about here shortly. The other program is SAPARD, and it's a special accession program for agricultural and rural development. And it's about half a billion a year. And it processing and marketing improvements, 26%, agricultural holdings, 20%, rural infrastructure, it's a primary focus of it, and other diversification. And again, Poland and Romania are the biggest challenges. A lot of the smaller ones also getting assistance from the European Union so that they can qualify for membership in the first place. Now, what are these candidates? Well, the Central European states, we have Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Slovenia. In the Baltic states, the traditional Soviet republics of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are joining the European Union. And the two Mediterranean islands, Cyprus and Malta, are also candidates to join within the next 12 months. And so let's just take a quick look at these. This is the European Union as reviewed in the previous session, the existing states that are there. We're adding Poland, which has a very unwieldy agricultural sector. That's the big challenge. They have about 27% of the workforce, and that's one of the most difficult for the European Union to really swallow. And its population is about a little under 40 million, and about 172 GDP in euros, and I won't go through all the numbers here. The next one to join is Hungary. It's very well prepared, politically and economically, and the one problem they have that's creating some concern are the treatment of minorities called Roma. You and I would know them as the gypsies, traditionally nomadic people that throughout the world, but the term, there actually is a common biological, ethnic, linguistic group called Roma, and these are a minority that are a source of concern throughout the region, but especially in Hungary. And again, a population of about 10 million in total, and not bad unemployment. Some of the unemployment, some of these are very, very difficult, very, very high. We have the Czech Republic. Czechoslovakia is split into two, as you recall. Well, Czech Republic is one of those two, and it is one of the best prepared candidates they have. It's got some disputes with Austria over some nuclear plants and some other things, but it looks like it's done well because of its position as a neighbor to Austria, and both Austria and Germany. So there's high levels of foreign investment. It's doing quite well. About 10 million people, but unemployment about 8%. We have Slovakia. That's the other half of what you all of us know as Czechoslovakia. It's passed an important hurdle just this year, and there are some concerns. Typically, in each of these countries, there's concerns by the EU of money laundering, crime, and civil infrastructure issues that they're dealing with budget. And only 5 million people here, but a unemployment of 20%. Then we have Slovenia. and it's the only candidate country from the former Yugoslavia. That was also the most prosperous after Cyprus of all of these, per capita income of some 70% of the European Union average. And so, but it still has some challenges, and they're working those through. A population of less than 2 million, small little country, unemployment about under 6%, and so on. All of these are major trading partners with the EU in the first place anyway. And then we have Estonia. This is one of the traditional Baltic republics of the Soviet Union. Its trade is predominantly with the EU already, and there's a levels of inward foreign investment per capita are among the highest in Central and Eastern Europe. And so it's the Estonians, interestingly enough, have really taken to information technology. They're boasting the largest number of internet connections of all the European candidate countries. And a population of about 1.5 million, and but the unemployment's up 12%, which is some concern. Next is Latvia. It's got a functioning market economy, but it still needs reform because it's not quite finished with its privatization program, still vestiges of the Soviet rule. Its problems also is the treatment of minorities. In this case, the largest minority are ethnic Russians, and they lack citizenship, so they've got some issues to deal with there. And the European Commission is talking about giving them a new language law to make it easier for the minorities to integrate into Latvian society and so forth. And so they all have their challenges. I'll spare you all the details, but they're all very similar, typically social infrastructure issues. Here we're talking about 2.5 million people and unemployment about 16%, getting up there. And then we have Lithuania. It's really a bridge between the Russian Baltic enclave Kaliningrad into the west of Lithuania and the mainland of Russia. And so it's acting as a corridor there. They've arranged some special open borders paperwork so that the Russians can get transit documents at the border to transit Lithuania to get to Kaliningrad and so forth. So there's some post-Soviet problems to work out, but it seems to be going well. Everybody's quite encouraged. Unemployment is persistently high, but those things are all being dealt with. Then we have this, probably the littlest of them all, Malta. It meets all the economic conditions for membership, interestingly enough. And unemployment is relatively low, but the GDP growth has been steady. And it's been part of the free trade zone with the EU since back in 71. Since Bob Cornuc has just discovered the four anchors of Paul that were discharged in Acts 27, the famous shipwreck scene, by following the details in Luke's account in Acts 27, he found the anchors exactly where the Bible implied they are. That's all been validated. But that's also going to lead to increased tourism. It's going to be a big thing, we believe. So anyway, Malta has a bright future ahead of it. It's an easy problem. You're dealing with only 400,000 people total, and the unemployment's low and heavily tourist-oriented. And there is Malta, a little tiny island, Mediterranean. Then we have Cyprus, and it's following the Turkish invasion of 1974. It complicates because there's a whole dispute between Greece and Turkey, especially over the northern part of the island. But those things seem to be being worked out. There's some threats both ways, but it's going to be turbulent. But it looks like that's on track to come into. And again, we're dealing with a small item, very low. Low unemployment in the southern part of the island. There is major problems in the economic turmoil in the northern Turkish part. But that's Cyprus. So there we are. Now, those are all scheduled to enter the European Union by 2004. There are three other candidates, two of them scheduled in 2007, Bulgaria and Romania. Now, Romania is, along with its neighbor Bulgaria, is due to join in 2007. It's making slow progress, adopting the European Union legislation. It's passed laws. It's accomplishing a lot, but there's big work ahead of it. That's why the EU has budgeted substantial support to bring them into qualification for membership. 22 million people. Unemployment is not that large. It is, again, though, agriculturally based. And we have Bulgaria also scheduled the same also in 2007. And it's got economic challenges that the EU is assisting with, so it looks like it'll be on schedule too. You're talking about 15 million people there, but unemployment's up to 19%. It's up there pretty high. So that's the enlarged EU, as you see on the map here, with one more. Well, let's just take a quick look. The dark blue on the map is the existing EU. The light blue are the nations that are joining: Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, and Slovenia. And then in 2007, we have two more. We have Romania and Bulgaria. So that creates is the lineup as it stands, with one enigma remaining, and that's the issue of Turkey. And that deserves some comment, both from an EU point of view, our own strategic point of view, because Turkey is a member of NATO. They're not a member of the EU, and there's great debate as to whether they will become. And they're also a major player in the prophetic end times. So we want to pay a lot of attention to Turkey. And it's obviously very strategically placed between Europe and Asia, traditionally so. Well, remember, it was once the capital of the world when the Roman Empire ruled. Everybody thinks of Rome because of our Western European tradition. But the capital of the world was moved in 312 to Constantinople. And so Turkey was, it ruled it for three times the length or more than Rome did. Turkey represents a population of about 65 million and a significant GDP, about 164 billion euros GDP. And so let's take a look a little bit at Turkey's background. It was with the decline of the Byzantine Empire in the 14th century, Turkish tribes in Anatolia, which constitutes the eastern two-thirds of what we call Turkey today, established the Ottoman Empire, which lasted all the way from the 14th century all the way to the end of World War I. When the modern state of Turkey emerged from that conflict. But you need to understand, to really understand Turkey, you need to understand Ataturk, a very unusual leader. Right following World War I, Kemal Ataturk aggressively transformed Turkey from a theocratic autocracy under Islam into a Western-oriented democracy. It's a dramatic step. In 1922, he abolished the Sultanate. In 1924, he abolished the Caliphate and the religious courts. In 1925, he made it illegal to wear the fez, which he regarded as a sign of backwardness. And but he didn't stop there. After ridding Turkey of the trappings of its Islamic background, in 1925, Turkey adopted the Western calendar. Can you imagine a culture that goes that far back changing its calendar? I mean, just think about that. That's wild. In 1926, he adopted the Swiss Civil Code and later the Italian Penal Code. In 1928, he switched to the Latin alphabet. He changed the alphabet of this country. And in 1931, he adopted the metric system. In 1934, all Turks were obliged to take a surname. Mustafa Kemal became Kemal Atatürk. And by the way, the women were also given the vote. So that's his legacy. Now, following World War II, Turkey joined all the main Western institutions. The UN in 1945, the IMF in 47, the OECD in 1948, the Council of Europe in 49, NATO in 1951. It's a NATO member. That's very important. And in 1963, after 4 years of application, Turkey received associate membership in the European Community with the express condition that they would be allowed full membership. That was the lure. That was what they were after. And however, the big problem began in 1987 because Turkey applied for full membership in the European Community, which it was in those days. And that was specifically what they had been promised. Their application in 87 was ahead of Austria, Finland, Sweden, and Norway. And all those applications were accepted and expedited. Norway declined to finally close, but still they were approved from the EU point of view. So it's now becoming clear to Turkey that they're not welcome, that they've just been rejected behind the scenes. Now this gets, they're still trying very, very hard. You may recall the tensions over the Iraq War. Turkey declined to allow the U.S. use of its bases, despite our commitment to give them, if they would, $80 billion in aid. Can you imagine? And still they balked at that because the pressure was being put onto them by France and Germany both, but especially France. Realize Turkey also had already lost their largest trading partner after the 1991 Gulf War. So the Middle East, what's interesting as you watch the dynamics, the Middle East isn't the issue to them, it's the European Union. France and Germany are vying for control of that. And pressured by France, France was previously very favored by oil contracts with Iraq. That's why they were opposing. In fact, France and Germany both are very, the anti-American sentiment there is very, very important to understand. Gerhard Schroeder won his election by taking an anti-U.S. position. and he's been against us in the UN, as we'll talk about shortly. So the anti-U.S. sentiment, not just in Germany and France, but throughout Europe, is substantial and growing. We need to realize that. And to get some, this energy issue is a big issue, because here's a chart of the world energy consumption. The United States uses about 25% of the world energy, the European Union is 16%, but recognize it's a population larger than ours, their use will be growing more rapidly than ours. And the rest of the other countries are relatively mild. Even China is only 9%, but it also will be growing. So energy is going to increasingly be a very, very key aspect on the geopolitical horizon. Energy production and consumption. On the chart here, you see the production is in blue and the consumption is in red. And while many of them aren't that bad, you can see that Germany and France are way just destitute of their own sources of energy. That's why France has invested heavily in nuclear, although EU is closing some down. So we'll watch to see how that goes. But clearly, the source of oil is not so critical to the United States. We import somewhere between 10-15%, but it's crucial for Europe. So Europe's attitude and orientation in the Middle East is very different. And their own energy reserves are incredibly modest, just fractional percents of most things. They have 16% of the refining capacity, but very little capacity. They have only 4.5% of the world's crude oil, 9% of the world's natural gas, and 7% of the world's coal. So they're in trouble in a source of energy mode. Getting back to Turkey, so there are three major factors that seem to be bringing about a change in the Middle East, especially in regards to Turkey. The deferrals by the European Union of Turkey's application for membership is one of those issues. I might mention when I was at the Air War College, I had the privilege of speaking and discussing this with several of the top Turkish officers. And they're very optimistic that Turkey will be allowed to join the EU. And I think that's interesting because the arguments seem to be against, and I'll show you some of them. One is that they deferred already so long. And the opening up of the Turkic world of Central Asia, that's opening up, and that's probably going to be their primary economic opportunity. But the other thing is the rise of Islamic fundamentalism throughout the Turkish world is a very real factor. If you take the Muslims in Europe, there's about 7.5% of the population of France is Muslim, about 4%, give or take, 3 or 4%, Netherlands, Germany, Britain, and so forth. The others are a matter of a couple of percent. And that's from The Economist, these statistics. So the Europe in total Muslim population is about 13 million. If Turkey joins the European Union, they will bring in 63 million Muslims in addition. So that's never mentioned in any of the ambassador reports and things I've seen, but it doesn't take a lot of imagination to realize that that is a factor, whether they will admit it publicly or not. But the other reason we watch Turkey so intently is because we believe it has a prophetic role. Many of you who are Bible buffs know about the Magog invasion in Ezekiel 38 and 39, which emphasizes the participation of Meshech and Tubal. Those are the two principal cities in ancient Anatolia. So that's a biblical way of alluding to Turkey, what we call Turkey. And so although Turkey is a pro-West, a member of NATO, it will be surprising to me if they do, in fact, join the EU, because they clearly are a major player in this Russian-led invasion of Israel that is so prominent in biblical prophecy that is yet on our horizon. So Magog being the forebear of the ancient Scythians, which in turn were the forebear of the true Russians, I won't go through all the tribal names, but if you do your Bible homework, you know that there's this famous invasion of Israel that is the occasion when God intervenes on behalf of Israel in a very dramatic way, and I commend that to your study. But the timing of that battle is controversial among Bible scholars. Many associate it with the Battle of Armageddon, which climaxes this famous 7-year period, and If this is new to you, I encourage you to really study this last four verses of Daniel 9 and understand what we call the 70-week prophecy of Daniel. But most Bible buffs who understand this recognize that the 7-year period climaxes the Battle of Armageddon. Many people, Hal Lindsey and other experts, believe that the Battle of Armageddon is what precipitates the second coming of Christ. That the Magog invasion occurs at the end of that 7-year period as part of what we call the Armageddon scenario. There are some of us that suspect that the Magog invasion is actually separate, in fact distinct from, happens prior to that whole period of history. And that means that those of us that hold that view, Grant Jeffries, myself, Chuck Smith, and others, that means that from our point of view, the Magog invasion could be on our near horizon. And so that's something that's worth doing your own homework, coming to your own conclusions, and watch the papers. We'll see. You should also recognize, as we talk about Europe, there's another alliance you should be sensitive to. In 1999, on the 50th anniversary of NATO, NATO redefined itself as a world police force. That chilled our allies as well as our adversaries, and what was a response to that, within 2 years, the Shanghai Pact was signed in direct response to this move. Russia, China, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, is virtually almost all of Central Asia, Russia and China, signed the Shanghai Pact, which specifically addresses what they call the hegemony of the United States. So Russia and China's military forces are joining in training operations, practicing their war games, assume an ultimate war with the United States. And more than once a year, they go through very elaborate exercises for training purposes. And so you need to recognize that we have some major, major antagonism. Not just Europe. We have Russia, China, and Central Asia also as an alliance specifically concerned with the dominance of the United States. So that's something else to be sensitive to and watch. Well, what are the prospects going forward? We've talked about where the European Union is today. Let's look ahead a little bit. There are 48 potential political units that theoretically could make up a combined heartland concept here. And the ones in blue on the chart are the ones already members. The ones in orange on the chart are those that are scheduled to join, with the enigma of Turkey, assuming they join in this case. And that still leaves a handful of others. Now, that leaves Europe, in any case, with a language problem. There are 38 active official languages in the nations that we've been dealing with. And I won't go through them all. There's actually about 8 different groups of languages: Slavic languages, Germanic languages, Romance languages, Celtic, Greek, Albanian, Basque, and so forth. So, lots of them. Now, they're committed to a single foreign policy. That sounds simple, but it isn't. There's a lot of barriers to that ever really taking place. First of all, several of them are traditional neutrals. Sweden, Finland, and Ireland, traditionally neutral in these past conflicts. There are many that have colonial possessions that are critical to them. UK, France, Portugal, Spain still have colonial possessions that are at variance here. And the issue of permanent UN Security Council seats comes up. UK and France both have 2 of the 5 permanent seats. And then there's this whole issue of the eastward expansion, which will double the EU membership in the UN. And by the way, in the Security Council, unanimous consensus is required for changes. So the possibility of making any changes at all is pretty cloudy. As we read this, you say, on the one hand, these are problems, and yet we can't help but be reminded in Daniel 2 how he speaks of the iron mixed with clay, that it gets brittle, it won't adhere. And that's the way he describes the iron empire that started, you know, in the imagery of Nebuchadnezzar's famous dream. We have the iron mixed with clay. So that's one possibility. Maybe this is what the allusion was to here. The other thing they're providing for is a composite defense. Not all these countries are members of NATO. Sweden, Finland, and Ireland are not. Norway is within NATO, but not in the EU. And so on. So, and then there's the issue of nuclear weapons. This is a thorny one, because both France and UK possess nuclear weapons. And that's going to be a hot topic within their own councils. And, of course, there's very differing foreign policies among the members. And that, of course, also clouds their ability to mount a common defense. A couple of other things have come along. The steel tariff wars leading to competitive isolation is something that we've experienced between the U.S. and Europe. Over the decades, we encouraged the European unification, believing that we were assisting a potential Atlantic partner. We're discovering that we've really got an isolated competitor rather than a partner. And they're showing up in the tariff wars. There's another way it's showing up. I'll bring this up here. It's about as good a place as any. I just received this, that the UN Security Council has approved, which should be routine but wasn't, a 1-year exemption for the American peacekeepers from prosecution by the new International War Crimes Tribunal. And the discussion should have been routine, but France, Germany, and Syria opposed this. It ultimately passed 12-0 with those three abstaining. But UN Secretary Kofi Annan spoke out strongly against the principle here. He wants to make sure there's no thought of making this permanent. America has been pushing for it to be a permanent exchange. We oppose the court. We believe that anyone that's not a signature of the court shouldn't be subject to it. The Bill Clinton administration signed the 1988 Rome Treaty setting up the court, but the Bush administration has rescinded the U.S. signature. President Bush contends that Americans could be subject to court's jurisdiction even if it's not a party to the pact. That's what he's concerned about. Washington argues that the court could be used for frivolous or politically motivated prosecutions of American troops. And so in addition to the exemption, it has signed bilateral agreements with 37 countries not to prosecute American officials. That is seeking more. And so it's a tense thing. It's, again, this whole global court issue. It's again, a place where even the sovereignty of the United States is being challenged, where we're not part of that court, but there are those that are presuming that that's just inevitable, that eventually we will be. And Britain has discovered, much to their shock, that the micromanaging that occurs in their lives from Brussels is disturbing. They can't. Brussels can control whether or not you can run a lawnmower at 5 o'clock on Sunday afternoons, and that sort of thing. So there's some things happening here. So there are some perspectives of tension here. There is an assisted suicide case in Britain that's being appealed to the International Court. That shocked the Brits, not the issue, the particular issue so much as the fact that the people are looking to the International Court as a higher court than the highest court in Britain. That's troubled the Brits somewhat. While all this is going on, of course, European and American media are condoning and encouraging the terrorism in Israel in a variety of ways. So we need to watch that. I might mention the European Union has granted 6 billion euros to the Palestinian Authority. So there are some major tensions. We won't list them all. Let's get a perspective of Europe in a broader sense. The whole world gross domestic product. Europe accounts for about 28% of the total world, again, which is about equal to the United States, interestingly enough. But obviously destined to grow as they take in more of the world in the European Union. And so between the Europe, United States, and the rest of the world, it's roughly balanced. And if you look at the economic summary, of course, Germany is clearly the leader in the European, the existing membership, France running a second, France and the United Kingdom, about a toss-up between them. And what's interesting, if you resort the slide by average mean income, Luxembourg, of course, comes to the top, where the average in here is about 25,000 euros, Luxembourg is about 58. So it's obviously a small conclave of professionals and well-paid paid people. But the candidate economies, so the ones that are joining, Poland and Czech Republic and Hungary are being the largest of the three largest of the 10. But we'll put this all together in a summary here. The European members today constitute a population base of 340 million people. By 2004, they're going to add 75 million to that, and in 2007, another 31 million. So they'll have a population base, not counting Turkey, of 446 million population. They'll collectively constitute an economic gross domestic product of about 9.7 trillion euros. Now, the United States has a gross domestic product of about 10 trillion euros against a population base of about 280 million. You say, gee, that's pretty interesting. We have a population that's much larger than ours and a GDP approximating close to ours. It's worse than that. I'll come to that in a minute. In other words, in 2004, they'll be 48% larger. In 2007, they'll be 60% larger than we are. Now, this is not a backward economy. Here's R&D investment of the Europe, the EU, and Japan, just to give you a perspective. Europe is coming right along in their R&D commitments. Let's talk a little bit about common currency. One of the things I didn't really emphasize in the previous historical rundown was the role of common currency in the formation and the control of the Roman Empire. The Romans used coins about at least 290 BC, if not sooner, and they issued these coins bearing the name of the ruling emperor. So these coins were used from Scotland to the Sahara and from Portugal to Iran. They were an informal way of providing cohesion, economic cohesion. Because if you're traveling, they would be recognized, and they had value just by virtue of their mintage. And the Romans, as they started conquering tribes, of course, carried these throughout the regions that they went. And at a time when it took 2 months to travel from London to Rome, this centralized authority implied by the coins is a powerful element of cohesion. In fact, in the 3rd century, Emperor Caracalla is said to have ordered the entire population of Thrace into slavery for refusing to use the standard Roman coinage. Thrace is roughly equivalent to Bulgaria, but apparently the emperor had them all, ordered them all sold into slavery for failure to countenance the Roman coin. So that was a factor in the Roman era that we overlooked. So even as it starts to come apart, there's a cultural commonality that's constant all of them. In the 8th century, Charlemagne established uniform silver coinage in establishing his empire. In the 9th century, there's another thing that happened. The Danegeld was a form of coin. It was a form of tribute paid by terrified countries to prevent attacks by the marauding Vikings. And that was, strangely enough, a form of tribute that became widely used in the Scandinavian area. Napoleon considered trying to enforce a uniform currency. And the Latin Monetary Union and the Scandinavian Monetary Union are both attempts at this, but they really failed. They weren't very successful. But the euro, of course, is the emergent currency from the European Union. It was in view from the Treaty of Rome back in 86, the Single European Act, the Treaty of European Act in 92. But it really takes shape in 1999 with the European Monetary Union formalized. And in 2001, the euro was introduced as a legal currency. There are 12 member states. Out of 15 members, 12 are participating. Denmark, Sweden, and the United Kingdom are not currently participating, but it's going to be a hot topic for Tony Blair in the UK. And so there are arguments both ways. I won't take you through that. We'll just watch with great interest as that unfolds. But something else is going on. The European Central Bank has been quietly stockpiling gold, pursuing the goal of making the euro an asset-based currency in contrast to the U.S. dollar, which is a debt-based currency. And they've been quietly acquiring gold through Canada from several companies, Newmont and Barrick and some others. And so they're very quietly, very low profile, but they appear to be stockpiling gold. This is apparently well known within the gold traders. Well, what's happened, though, also in the last recent months, let's say a year and a half more, is the euro has gone from its 85 cents to $1.19. And the implications of that are, and it's very steady, and the implications of that are extremely profound. Let's examine some of the implications. Most of us, I'm guilty of it too, think, a euro is like a dollar. Well, not quite. In terms of central bank reserves, about 68% of the banks use dollars for as their reserves, but 13% and growing are the euros, according to the International Monetary Fund last year. But the chief economist from the Deutsche Bank made an interesting mark. He says a lot of the central banks, particularly in Asia, where the dollar volume is most important, are shifting reserves from dollar reserves into euros. That's already starting to happen. And the bond market, the U.S. still constitutes about 46% of the bond market, the euro about 24%, but growing. The yen about 19%, just for perspective. Now, let's go back and look at this chart that deals with the EU GDP. 9.7 trillion euros is their GDP against our $10 trillion. But we just found out that the euro is worth $1.19, which means in equivalent terms, the European economy here totalized as of 2007, assuming these member states join in and allowing no growth for them so far, you're still talking about a collective economy that's about 14% larger than the U.S. is today. And that comes as a shock. It did to me when I was doing the research for this briefing. I knew it was getting close. I had didn't realize that it actually eclipsed it. The population base is about 60% larger. You say, well, gee, yes, but it's agriculture. Yes, but it's growing. These are not illiterates. This is a cultural tradition that values education. They're doing something different. See, we get our low-cost labor through NAFTA in Mexico and what have you. What they're doing is they're taking the low-cost labor, bringing it in under the shelter. It'll be in their tax base. So as these countries grow and prosper, it will strengthen the Federated Union, if you will. And the mean income per capita is worth taking a look at here, because if you look at these the ones that are joining here, you've got everything from 15,000 euros per annum down to 2,000 in Lithuania. Cyprus, Slovenia, and Malta being at the top of the list. Most of these are 4,000 or 5,000 euros per year mean income. And of course, Romania and Bulgaria is down in the 2000 category also. The EU members have the income average, a mean income of about 27,000 euros per year. The ones joining in 2004 are 5,000, 2007 less than 2,000. So that all represents opportunity for growth. Just bring, as they will, naturally, as they prosper and things go, their means will begin to approximate the pre-existing members. So they'll have a composite of about 21,000 per year, but that'll obviously be growing. That's against the United States, 35,000, or I'll call $36,000 per year, mean income in the United States. Just to give you a perspective of this. And, of course, the EU being substantially larger in its potential, it gets kind of interesting. Well, we talk a lot about global government, and that's part of what's going on here. Let's talk a little bit about the EU's UN participation. The EU nations on the United Nations Security Council, France, Germany, Spain, and UK. Two of these are permanent members, as well as one nation currently applying for membership in the EU. That's Bulgaria as a member, and they'll be applying for membership in the EU too. See, all EU members and candidates are members of the UN itself. They have 9 spots on the Economic and Social Council. The EU will make up 25 of the 191 members, about 13%, just in terms of the General Assembly. Let's talk about budget. This surprised me too. This is the support of the regular budget. The European Union provides 37% of the UN budget. The United States provides 23%. I didn't realize that. I thought we were the big gorilla on the block. Apparently not. Apparently, from the official numbers, I see the European Union's 37% against the U.S.'s 23%. And Japan, about 20%, and all the others add up to 20%. That's the regular budget. They have a separate peacekeeping budget. And of that, the United States provides 28%. The European Union provides 40%. I was startled by that. Very surprising. And this is the year 2001 to 2003 perspective here. So EU is again, the big gorilla on the block here. Now, in the Security Council, there's 15 members, 5 permanent seats, 10 elected by the General Assembly for 2-year terms. And decisions require an affirmative vote by at least 9, including all 5 permanent members. That's where you get this idea of the veto. So all 5 have to agree on anything that goes on. And you should realize that the UN Security Council is the only entity that has the power to impose obligatory policies, at least so far. And so that's a big issue. And there's all kinds of proposals for changes, but it'll take unanimous consent for changes, so they have little likelihood of happening. Moscow's proposed that the Security Council include 5 other permanent members, enlarge it, in other words, Germany, Japan, 1 Asian country, 1 African country, 1 American country, and they also proposing that India become a permanent Security Council member. And Italy and Spain both have claimed the right to be represented on the Security Council. So there's a lot of tensions and jockeying around, and that cauldron will continue to bubble. You can't talk about Europe without at least taking a quick look at the Vatican. And it shocked me to realize in recent years how the people I regard as the most conservative in a religious sense are the people trying to lead the ecumenical movement. Most of us, I think, recognize that biblical Christianity is increasingly becoming politically incorrect, even here in America. And what's interesting to me is that the Vatican that's positioning for global ecumenical leadership. That's important to understand, because you really won't understand the history of Europe unless you have studied the tensions. Most of the wars in Europe resulted from the grappling for power, temporal power, by the Vatican. And you need to understand that. If you haven't studied that, I encourage you to take a look at the briefing pack Dave Hunt and I did called We Call the Kingdom of Blood, or better yet, get his book called The Woman Rides the Beast, one of the best documented books on this issue. Essential reading for any serious Christian. But in any case, the Vatican's a major player here. And to give you some feeling here, the Vatican has endorsed the Quran. So you need to realize it's all power here. And you combine the billion Muslims with the existing power base of the Vatican. It's very shrewd politics, but it's very disturbing in terms of its long-term implications. Now, it's interesting, this has already come up where the Vatican didn't have the leverage you might think they had. There's currently going on the Convention for the Future of Europe, forming a draft constitution for Europe. And the mention of God and Christianity has been deleted from those drafts. And the secularists have contended that, quote, a clearly pluralist modern Europe has moved beyond any reference to any particular religion, as they're called. And even when the former Irish Prime Minister, John Burton, formally proposed, including, and by the way, his constitution actually opens with a mention of the Holy Spirit. He proposed including a mention of Christianity, and the proposal failed to muster enough support, so the document, with all that expurgated from it, it now goes to the 25 member countries for parliamentary approval. So we're beginning to see that complexion. It shouldn't surprise us. Something else you should be aware of that colors all of this in my mind, and that's the national anthem. It may surprise you to discover that Europe does indeed have a national anthem. They take it very seriously. And it's an incredible piece of music. It's Beethoven's 9th so-called choral symphony in D minor, opus 125. And the choral stands, he shocked the musical world by having the curtains open and a choral group singing words to a symphony. That was just unheard of in those days. But anyway, the stanzas were adapted by Beethoven from Schiller's Ode to Joy, a famous German poet. In German, it says, Freude, Tochter, aus Elysium, deine Zauber binden wieder, was die Mode strengt geteilt. Alle Menschen würden brüder, wo dein Sanster Flügel feilt. Or putting it in English, Joy, O daughter of Elysium, thy pure magic frees all others held in custom's rigid rings. Men throughout the world are brothers in the haven of thy wings. It's a call to world federation, interestingly enough. And so, it's incredible music. Obviously, every time you hear that, it'll ring in your ears for days. And I first thought this was just a side issue, but when I was in the European Parliament, I had the opportunity to actually pick up the earphones, and when nothing else was going on, which was when I was passing through there, picked up, and it's playing. That is their national anthem. Very interesting. Well, we've reviewed in these two sessions the biblical background as to why scholars have for decades been looking for a reemergence of the Roman Empire. And it certainly would seem that the foundation of that's being set. We reviewed the fragmentation of Western Europe. Now remember, the eastern leg endured for another 1,000 years, but the fragmentation of Western Europe occurred very much as suggested by Nebuchadnezzar's dream. We followed the aspirations of a Holy Roman Empire through several iterations in Europe's subsequent history. And we took it all the way through to the end of World War II, where we see the reemergence of what I'll call Rome II, apparently emerging on our horizons, the European Union. We talked about it today, and we talked a little bit about what's forthcoming in the next few years, 2004, 2007 acquisitions. And so the real question in our minds is, okay, what's next? And it's very easy, perhaps, you can say, gee, we're just reading into the Bible the current events as we see them. And it's always a possibility. So let's examine what other things are very unlikely to happen on the current geopolitical horizon, and yet would seem to be suggested by the biblical text. What about the eastern leg? Remember, Nebuchadnezzar's dream had two legs, a western and eastern one. And to the best of my awareness, there is no thought, even from the visionary dreamers in Europe, of reaching to the Middle East. And yet, if we take the Bible seriously, it would seem that somewhere, somehow, the ancient eastern leg, what we call the Byzantine Empire, has a role to play here somehow. Is it going to emerge somehow? That sounds preposterous today, but I love those kinds of things because it's not likely in our horizon. If and when it does happen, it'll cause you to go back to the Scripture and read it more carefully. There's another issue that gets mixed with this whole reemergence of the Roman Empire, Rome II, if you will, and that is, will a super leader of some kind emerge? And when will that happen? Who will he be? And he goes by many different names. There's 33 titles in the Old Testament, 13 in the New. It's got many labels. We tend to call him, or some groups tend to call him, the Antichrist. And so where will he emerge from? Traditionally, many scholars have taken for granted that he will emerge out of the Roman Empire, and from that they assume it's Western Europe. Maybe not. From Micah 5 and Isaiah 10 and some other passages, there's strong indication indicate that he will come out of the eastern leg, in fact, literally out of Iraq-Syria area. And There's also a big debate. Is he a Gentile? Is he a Jew? There's arguments both ways. Well, everybody forgets there's two guys. It's a duet. Read Revelation 13. So that's a whole issue there, a place where we do some serious study, because there's much speculation on the horizon. The Assyrian idea is emphasized in Micah 5, verses 5 and 6, Isaiah 10, several passages in Ezekiel and elsewhere. Another issue is, what will the role of Babylon be? It's interesting that through the whole Iraq war, the most important city in Iraq was never mentioned. The city of Babylon, that Saddam Hussein had begun the rebuilding of. It has a huge destiny that many, even good Bible scholars, haven't focused on. And what will its role be? And it's my anticipation that you're going to see an increasingly important role for Babylon to emerge in the coming months and years. Watch for it. It should be exciting. Is a literal city on the banks of the Euphrates? I believe Isaiah and Jeremiah make that very clear. On the other hand, is it a coded symbol of some kind? That's what Dave Hunt developed so thoroughly in his book, Woman Rides the Beast. Or could it be that both of these ideas are somehow commingled, which is our view? But check it out, do your homework, and just watch the news broadcast, because all these things are surfacing. And that leaves a primary challenge that I want to leave you with before we close. And it's an assertion that I'm going to make that I'm counting on you to challenge. It's so preposterous. I hope you don't just accept it. I hope you will take the effort to challenge it. I believe that you and I are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in human history, including the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee or climbed the mountains of Judea. Now that's a preposterous statement. I'm suggesting that you and I are moving into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about the gospel period. Now, the way you challenge this idea is you've got to do two things. You've got to find out what the Bible really says about these things, not what Chuck Missler or some or whoever your favorite prophecy buff might be. Find out for yourself what the text really says and be very precise about it. That's the easy part. The other thing you need to do is find out what's going on. That's not so easy, because we have a mainline news media that has an agenda of its own. But fortunately, with the helps that are around, especially on the internet and so forth, with a little effort, you can find out anything if you know what questions to ask. So find out what the Bible really says, and find out what's really going on. And I think what you're going to discover is some exciting things. We have traditionally monitored 10 strategic trends that are impacting all of us, our nations, our communities, our families, our persons. There are 10 strategic trends we monitor on our website. You check it out. The rise of the European superstate. We've talked about that in this particular briefing. And we touched briefly on ecumenical religion and global government. They're related topics in a sense. We haven't talked about weapons of mass destruction. What do they play? What's their biblical background? And how do they play out in our future? What forcing functions do they impose on us geopolitically? The rise of Islam, major factor. Tragic illiteracy in this country. It's prey to the propaganda. Find out what Islam really believes. Find out what its agenda is. Find out for yourself. And the struggle for Jerusalem. Here's a topic that, as we're having this briefing, the late lights are burning in every capital around the world, struggling what issue to take about the city of Jerusalem. That's exactly what Zechariah predicted would happen and will endure until the Prince of Peace comes. And the Magog invasion, we touched on briefly, but that's a whole study in its own right. The rise of China as a superstate. You know, for 50 years, the world has had a balance due to the tension between two superpowers, USSR and the USA. It appears that in the coming decades, the two dominant powers on the planet Earth will be Asia on the one hand, Europe on the other. And that has implications for all of us. Biotech and global pestilence. Every day in the paper there's some issue here. This is a very, very key topic in our lives in general and in your biblical perspective in particular. And of course, all this leads to what I'll call the American challenge. Where are we headed? What's going to happen in our country? And that's a topic for another briefing. Now, we do have resources we'd like to make available to you. Let me invite you. We publish a monthly, a 48-page monthly news journal. And we'll give you a year's subscription free of charge just by calling us and asking for it. It's our attempt to highlight the biblical relevance of current events. And we encourage you to take a look at it. We hope you find it useful. By all means, check out our website. Our ministry is called Koinonia House. No one can pronounce it, let alone spell it. So everyone calls us K House. So our website is khouse.org, khouse.org. Our phone number is 1-800-KHOUSE1, K-H-O-U-S-E, and then the number 1. On the website, we monitor our strategic trends. All this is free access for you. We also make available, free of charge, a weekly emailed newsletter, just a one-pager, that describes what happened this week that's biblically relevant, and it will give you the links to those websites that are commonly following that particular special interest. And it's all free. You just sign on our website, give us your email address, we'll give that to you, give you that once a week until you tell us to turn it off for some reason. And the other agenda we want to encourage, one of our primary efforts is to encourage you to participate in a home fellowship of some kind. Some of these are sponsored by churches, some of these are used just on their own, but we encourage you to examine, explore, find a home fellowship to participate in. If you can't find one, start one. We'll be glad to help you. Because we're moving into the most exciting times in history, but you need to be prepared for it by doing your homework. God bless you.
For a complete listing of materials to further enhance your personal Bible study, or to receive a free one-year subscription to Chuck Missler's monthly Christian Intelligence News Journal, Personal Update, contact Koinonia House at 1-800-KHOUSE1. That's 1-800-KHOUSE1. Or you can write to Koinonia House at P.O. Box D, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816-0347. To fax your correspondence, dial 208-773-6312.